court is ready to hear argument in 030309 In Re Weekly Homes.
Good morning, and please report. This is a petition for a writ of mandamus to enforce a mandatory arbitration agreement on a person that did not sign the contract. Weekly constructed a new home for Vernon Forsting and his daughter, Patricia von Bergen. Mr. Forsting, the father, signed the real estate purchase agreement as purchaser, and although the daughter signed numerous transactional documents as purchaser, she did not sign the real estate agreement. The house was put on Mr. Forsting's name, the father, and after closing, he transferred title to the Forsting Family Trust. The daughter is the sole beneficiary of the trust. The father, the daughter, and the trust sued Weekly Homes alleging construction defects. Only the daughter's claim is in play in this proceeding. The daughter sued Weekly for personal injuries allegedly caused by Weekly's negligent performance of warranty work done pursuant to the home purchase agreement. The trial court refused to send the daughter's claim to arbitration and only sent Mr. Forsting's and the trust claims to arbitration. We believe, Your Honors, that we're entitled to a writ of mandamus because the trial court abused its discretion. Here we have a very broad arbitration provision. It provides that any claim or dispute or cause of action between the purchaser and the seller.
But the breadth of the provision says nothing about who's bound by it.
Would you repeat your question, Your Honor?
The breadth of the arbitration provision says nothing about who is bound by it.
No, Your Honor, we're dealing here with the scope. Nobody contests the fact that we have a very broad arbitration provision. It is relevant only in the sense that this is a claim for a construction defect.
I guess what I'm saying is the scope's really irrelevant to whether the daughter is bound by the provision, because I think the daughter would probably agree that if the provision binds her, it would encompass the claims here. But the question is whether she's bound by it. The scope's irrelevant to that determination.
The question here, Your Honor, is whether or not, under existing Texas law, she is bound by that broad arbitration agreement. And under Texas law, a party may be bound by an arbitration agreement even if she or he did not sign the agreement when the non-signatory is the third-party beneficiary to the contract, and we submit to the court that the evidence is compelling that she's a third-party beneficiary, or when the non-signatory sues on the contract, and we believe that the evidence is compelling, again, that she's suing under the contract. I will discuss these two provisions with the court. I will leave for the brief the policy, public policy reasons why we think we ought to prevail. For example, in Prudential versus Marshall, this court said that the policy in favoring enforcing arbitration agreements is so compelling that a court should not deny arbitration unless it can be said with positive assurance that an arbitration clause is not susceptible to an interpretation which would cover the dispute at issue. Also in Anglin versus Tips.
But again, that goes to public policy to enforce what parties have agreed to and doesn't answer the question of whether the party has agreed to this.
That's correct, Your Honor. Now let's look at the third-party beneficiary, because we believe we prevail under any of those four theories. This court has stated in MCI versus Texas Utilities that whether someone is a third-party beneficiary to a contract is a question of contract interpretation, which is a question of law for the court to decide. The court went on to say, a third-party beneficiary is one for whose benefit a contract is made and not one who is benefited only incidentally by the performance of the contract. And the court stated that the intention of the parties is controlling. In Fort Worth ISD versus the City of Fort Worth, this court held that to ascertain the party's intent, a court may read instruments pertaining to the same transaction together as if they were part of a single unified instrument. Now let's look at the facts that gave rise to this particular dispute. Mr. Forsting is a 78-year-old widower at the time. He decided to purchase a home for himself and for his daughter. He was a very sick man.
What if there had been a nurse living in the home with Mr. Forstein, and she had brought this claim? Would she be bound by the arbitration clause?
Only if Mr. Forstein evidenced an intent that she would be a third-party beneficiary. And we believe that here there's clear evidence that Mr. Forstein intended for his daughter to be a co-owner. Mr. Forstein testified that he considered himself a co-owner, an owner of the house. He considered the daughter a co-owner of the house. The daughter testified that she considered herself an owner.
Could she, under our, we've been fairly strict on determining who constitute third-party beneficiaries of contracts. Could she have sued Weekly for a right of possession to the home, for example?
Probably not.
Well, then how could she be a third-party beneficiary for some purposes but not for others? If she had no right to sue the home builder to enforce the contract, how can the arbitration provision be enforced on her?
Because the evidence is compelling here that Mr. Forstein intended for her to be a third-party beneficiary. Let us look at her conduct and Mr. Forstein's conduct with regard to this contract.
I understand, but I don't understand why that wouldn't work both ways. If she's a third-party beneficiary, why couldn't she sue for a right of possession?
Well, she may very well can. I'm not saying definitively that she could not, but that's not the question here. The question is there evidence in the transactional documents that Mr. Forstein intended for the daughter to be a beneficiary? And we say, yes,
well,
there is.
Well, again, we're talking about incidental beneficiary or an actual third-party beneficiary. It sounds to me like by carving out beneficiary of just the arbitration provision, that sounds more... I mean, to me, you're a third-party beneficiary for all purposes, not just for some. Or do you think you can just carve out pieces that you're a beneficiary?
I do not know that, Your Honor. I do not know the answer to that question. But I think if the court looks at the evidence in this case, you will see that Mr. Forstein intended for the daughter to be a co-owner. And of course you aren't. If she is a co-owner, certainly she is a third-party beneficiary.
So what if her children had sued? Again, not limiting your... You've alleged more than one theory. What is the scope of your theories? Are her children included within this? Would a servant who works in the home daily or a nurse who lives in the home, how far is the reach of any of your theories on who's bound by the arbitration clause?
Your Honor, I believe that the court can look to the cases dealing with termite inspection contracts like Orkin, Runhell, and Nationwide, or the court can look to what the Court of Appeals said in Merrill Lynch versus Smith and Eddings. In contracts involving family residence, the law presumes that the signing family member clearly intended the agreement to confer a direct benefit on the household members who occupy the residence. That is the reach of what we're asking the court to do.
Would that include employees or not, if they live in the home or work in the home?
Only if there's an evidence, you know, under the writings of this court in First Merit and in Prudential versus Marshall, if there is evidence of intent for the purchaser to confer a benefit, they are bound by the contract.
So this is probably going to be a one-time only, because after this, 78-year-old men will know not to testify at deposition. I intended her to be a beneficiary. So this is a one-time only ticket.
No, Your Honor, it is not. There are many contracts standing similar provisions. So what the court writes here, particularly in light of some writings in the Fleetwood versus Gaskamp case in the Fifth Circuit, there is tension there. So what this court writes in this case would be of great benefit to the bench and the bar.
Any evidence that that your client intended her to be a beneficiary?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which is?
Your Honor, his client, the daughter, paid the initial deposit toward the purchase home. The daughter signed a letter of intent as a purchaser. The daughter signed numerous transactional documents like the custom choices where she selected the floor plan, the colors, etc., and signed as a purchaser. She handled, as an owner, all of the negotiations with Weekly before the construction and after the construction. After they moved in, she sent Weekly a list of items that needed to be fixed and on, quote, our home. She demanded that the contract be enforced, that the warranty provisions of the contract be enforced by asking Wheatley to abide by those warranty provisions and fix and repair the home. So she accepted the benefits of the contract, Your Honor, by accepting a reimbursement check when she moved out of the house for the repairs to be made. She accepted the benefits of the contract and got a check for $552, and she said, I acknowledge that this check is for reimbursement while my home is being repaired. So there's ample evidence here, Your Honor, that she considered herself an owner of the home. And I'm saying, if she considered herself an owner, a cut below that is third-party beneficiary.
But my question was whether Wheatley considered her the owner. Your evidence that they intended her to be the owner is simply that they never objected.
They dealt with her as a co-owner, Your Honor, because she represented herself as a co-owner and signed numerous transactional documents. Now, in the remaining time, Your Honor, I'd like to move on to the other theory under which we prevail, suit under the contract.
I'm, like Justice Owen, concerned about the scope of the rule that you're asserting. In your brief, you say a litigant who sues based on a contract subjects him or herself to the contract's terms. What's the boundary there? What if a niece comes over and visits for the afternoon and there's some injury related to improper warranty work? Under that theory solely, would the niece's claims be subject to arbitration?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why not?
She's a guest. She would have other claims, perhaps. She could sue the owner of the home, not Wheatley.
I'm positing a suit against Wheatley Homes. And what if she constructs a theory based on contract to sue Wheatley? Would her claim be subject to arbitration?
Perhaps.
If it's based upon the contract.
Yes, Your Honor. This court can look at Valero and Associated Glass case and say if the tort that is alleged is so interwoven with the contract that it cannot stand alone, it falls within the scope of the agreement to arbitrate. If, on the other hand, the tort is completely independent of the contract and can be maintained without reference to the contract, it falls outside the scope.
In my question, I'm assuming that the claim is a contract claim. Okay, so we don't have to argue the points about intertwining tort and contract and contort issues. Assume that it's a contract claim. Can anybody who comes into the home and believes they were injured based upon faulty warranty work or faulty construction work fashion a breach of contract claim that is then subject to arbitration? Put standing issues to the side. Assume they can assert such a claim. What's the limits of your theory?
Your Honor, all we're asking this court to do is do what other courts in this state have done with regards to termite inspection contracts. When you're dealing with a family residence, the signer of the contract is presumed to confer benefits to the members that live in that residence. Now, that's all we're asking this court to do.
Are you suggesting that a theory that says any litigant who sues based on a contract subjects him or herself to the contract's terms, including arbitration, is too broad, just stated that way?
Your Honor, we're asking this court to follow what the court wrote in First Merit and in Prudential, and that is if the tort cannot exist but for the contract, and the party that is suing is trying to enforce the contract, that person is subject to arbitration. Here, Ms. Wheatley,
even if it's a pipe fitter who comes in to fix a faucet, or a yardman who's working in the yard and wants a drink of water and comes in, they fashion a theory based on the contract?
No, Your Honor. I think that cause of action by that pipe fitter or the contractor has a suit against a homeowner, not against Wheatley Homes.
Well, you're changing the facts of my question. Assume they can fashion a breach of contract claim. Would they be subject to arbitration? Because they sue based on the contract.
If they're trying to enforce the contract provisions, they sue under the contract, and they're subject to arbitration.
Yep.
They cannot have it both ways.
Without limits, yard man, the plumber.
Your Honor, if they're trying to enforce the contract and get benefits from the contract, They subject themselves to the contract provision.
So the answer to my question is yes. The yardman, the plumber, the niece.
The court doesn't have to write that broadly, Your Honor.
So you agree that a statement that of law that says if you sue based on the contract, you're subject to the contract's terms, that alone, without limitations, is too broad?
I would agree that that's too broad, Your Honor. We would ask you to confine your holding to family members, family residents, like the court has done in numerous cases involving termites. Your Honor, my time is up, unless there's
further
questions.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Spencer Brown will present argument
for the real party's interest. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Spencer Brown. I represent the real party interest, Patricia von Bargen. Mr. Gonzalez is correct that the two major issues before the court today are, number one, whether Ms. von Bargen is a third-party beneficiary to the contract, and number two, whether she is sued on the contract.
What precisely is her cause of action?
Number one, her cause of action is a strict personal injury claim. It's grounded in negligence. It's a common law claim. It's a common law claim for damages. No way does
she. And the source of the. You were negligent in repairing?
It was negligent in the workers repairing or attempting to repair the alleged defects within the house.
Okay, yes, remind me, what did they fail to do that caused her personal injury?
I believe it was a failure to collect some sort of insulation, maybe, or the actual some sort of contaminants that was used in their attempt in repair. That caused her to develop an asthmatic condition.
And where did the duty to perform the repairs come from?
Well, I think that duty is related to common law. I think that duty comes about of how you have a duty to...
So if I call up Wheatley Homes, even though they have nothing to do with my house, tell them to come out and repair it, they have to do it because it's the common law.
Well, that's not true, Your Honor, but of course this is not...
Clearly, their only duty to repair comes from the contract.
It does come from the. I mean, I will agree with you that it does come from the actual duty for them to show up to the house for them to do it does come from the contract. Although she is not herself suing based on the contract, she's not a party to the contract. She is suing.
But there's no negligence duty. I mean, for negligence, you've got to have a duty.
Absolutely.
And the duty's got to come from the contract.
Well, the duty can also come as being an individual who. I mean, yes, they do show up. As per the contract, but as she is not party to the contract, she cannot possibly sue on behalf of the contract. Now, I mean, I agree with you, number one, that we need to look at the contract itself to figure out whether or not she's a beneficiary to the contract. If we look at the contract itself, there's a specific provision that is labeled the dispute resolution clause. Within that, it says two words. This agreement is between the purchaser and the seller. Purchaser is defined numerous places throughout the contract. At the very top of the first page of the real estate contract, it labels purchaser as Vernon Forster, who is actually the father of Patricia von Bargen. At the end, it gives many spaces for the purchaser to sign. The only person who signs this document is Vernon Forster. On the bottom of every single page of that contract, it says purchaser's initials. The only initials present there are Vernon Forster.
If you were the home builder, and you wanted to be sure a claim like this was arbitrated, could you do it?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason I don't think that you can actually arbitrate this clause is, number one, you have to have an agreement that, number one, the home builder is the one that drafts the contract.
No, I'm saying starting at the beginning.
Okay.
So the home builder is saying, you know, there might be some other people living there, and I don't know. I want them bound by this arbitration agreement. So you're the lawyer. Bring back an agreement or something that binds them. How would you do it?
Very simply. I put in one sentence within that dispute resolution arbitration that says that this agreement, that this purchase agreement is bound by all occupants.
So the owner, whoever signs that, has waived the constitutional rights for everybody else.
Well, I mean, I would see that where your argument is going, where that they're actually waiving on behalf of someone else, and Maybe that's an unconscionable type of an argument. But isn't it almost more unconscionable to kind of look at it and say, by implication, that those rights exist for the home?
Well, all I'm saying is I think the thrust of your argument is this can't be done. A situation like this where the owner is a trust or some a corporation or some other entity, you can't have an arbitration agreement that covers the kind of claims that the home builder wants covered.
I mean, I think if we're dealing with a situation such as this, where there's a father, a husband, and a wife, who are all adults, and if the home builder simply believes that the father, the husband, and the wife are going to be the residents, that they are all going to be co-owners, as Mr. Gonzalez has stated, then why would they not simply put in a provision within the contract itself where they all can sign?
Children?
Children is another difficult issue. That is a difficult issue because...
It's difficult because you don't think it can be.
You think
Fleetwood is right, and therefore it can't be done.
Absolutely.
I
believe the court in Fleetwood did have it correct. Yes, Your Honor.
What about the termite cases? How do you distinguish those?
Well, number one, those termite cases are dealing with, I think, the majority of the Orkin case, dealing with a husband who contracts also, who is the only person who signs a contract. There's a wife who they're both elderly as well, and he signs the contract for a subterranean termite inspection on behalf of him and his wife. That is distinguishable for the sole reason is that's a service contract. And number one, number two, that is actually a suit that's based on the contract. The contract itself is existing there for termite inspection and for termite repellent or protection from termites. In this case, we're dealing with...
But in the termite case, I don't recall, did they assert personal injury actions?
The personal injury actions, as I remember, Your Honor, were not alleged because I believe the plaintiffs agreed in that actual trial court that the suit itself was based on the contract and that the whole argument within the termites cases were that they were not actually parties to the contract.
Forster had sued, would he be bound by the arbitration clause?
Yes, Your Honor. That has already been held by the trial court.
So this is, and you don't discuss my point. You don't dispute that.
No, we do not.
And so this really isn't about whether this is an independent tort claim or not. It's who's bound by this arbitration clause.
And number one, it's who's bound. But as a corollary to that argument, we're also saying that this is a tort argument.
Well, if Mr. Forster brought this exact same tort claim, would he be bound by the arbitration clause or not?
I think that he would be bound, Your Honor, because he is a party to the arbitration agreement.
What if he had signed the contract as a husband, purchasing separate property? Would his wife be bound by it?
Now, if the wife had not signed the contract, if this is just himself as a husband and a wife, and he just signed it on his own, and his wife is actually in the background, but he's going to live with him. That's a difficult question because it kind of goes to what we already talked about with GasCamp and now the fact that if you're contracting on behalf of people as a sole person in GasCamp, the father contracted on behalf of his wife.
No, he decides he wants to use separate property to buy the house for him and his wife. I mean, they're both going to live there, but he decides he wants to use his separate funds. So he's the only person that enters into the contract with Weekly Homes. And the wife brings a personal injury claim just like this one. Is she bound by the arbitration clause?
I would not think so, Your Honor. Number one, it's the husband's separate property that purchased the claim. And number two, there's the husband's only name not on the signature on the contract. He's the only one that entered into the contract. Now, if it was community property or if the wife did enter into the contract with him and she had to bring a personal injury or tort claim, I would believe that she
would. Now, what difference would it make if it were community property but the husband was the only signatory?
Well, if the husband is only signatory, he's signing on behalf of his wife as well.
Well, he just signs.
He just signs.
It turns out he used community funds to buy the home.
Well, I think that's a difficult issue, number one. And number two, I think that we have to always be governed by what the contract says and what the four corners of the contract say. And if the contract says that this is your sole purchaser of the actual home, then we must be bound by the people that construe the documents to begin with, which, and hopefully in this scenario, as it is in this one, would be the homeowner itself.
Do you agree that it would be inefficient to have two separate proceedings determine the same dispute?
Your Honor, I mean, I do understand.
As a general proposition.
Right. As a general proposition, yes, it's always inefficient to have two different tribunals decide the same issue. But here we're not dealing with the same issue.
Well, do you think it's a good idea to try to resolve the disputes in one proceeding instead of two?
I will always believe that's in the best interest of judicial economy, yes.
And in this case, has the father asserted only a contract claim, or does he have a tort claim,
too? His claims are only based on contract, and the daughter's the only one who brings a tort claim, Your Honor.
Do you think our decision in Merritt Bank was correctly decided or not? You don't try to distinguish it.
I don't distinguish that it's correct or not, although I do distinguish that it's different from the case at bar today and from the case in Gaskin as well. And your decision in First Amendment, the claims were so intertwined with each other. The claims were actually all based on the father's claims, the parents' claims and the children's claims were basically identical. They were exactly the same. Whereas in this case here today, we have the father of the trust having a separate contract claim and the daughter having a separate tort claim. So,
let's assume the whole family brought personal injury claims for asthma, like the father, the husband, the wife, and the grandchildren.
That's a very difficult issue because now we're dealing with the fact that...
How's that different from first merit?
Because, number one, we're dealing with the fact that the first merit, I believe that the general rule that we get on that is a suit based on the contract. And there, if the father is bringing a claim as the only signatory, or as the trust is bringing the claim as also the signatory to the contract, then he himself and the trust itself will be bound by the contract and bound to arbitration. Now, if they're also bringing a claim for personal injury, which is, I believe, what you stated then, I believe that claim becomes independent of the contract, and they would have a different recourse in the regular district trial.
But not the – you again can see that not the grandchildren. The signatory party, it doesn't matter if it's for personal injury or not. He's bound.
I'm sorry.
You don't draw that distinction with respect to the signatory party. If it's personal injury, they're still bound.
If it's personal injury, I do believe that the signatories to the contract are bound. If it's not personal injury, I mean, if it is personal injury and they're not signatories to the contract, I think it's going to have to come down to, I mean, as I just said, are they still signatories? Are they bound by the contract in some way, in some fashion? Or are they suing based on the contract? And as this court has said in first merit, suit based on the contract has got to come out from the contract itself.
What isn't the fact that your client accepted certain benefits, such as a $550 check or so, and signed as an owner, elevate her status to a third-party beneficiary?
I think that the fact that she accepted the benefits on behalf of her family for, I believe, staying in a hotel while they were attempting these repairs, has no bearing on her status as a third-party beneficiary.
Why not?
I believe that because, number one, she's acting as a resident of the house, and not as a purchaser of the house. I still go home to my parents' house in Kansas for Thanksgiving. And I know when they're out, I will go out and I'll try to do things on behalf of them, on behalf of their house. I don't call myself a purchaser or an owner of their house, although I will still accept benefits on their behalf for that house. Additionally, I think that the documents that stated that say that she intended to be a actual owner of the house was only one document that was entitled a letter of intent, which was signed well before the actual purchase agreement was signed. This letter of intent even specifically states at the bottom, this note is only to be construed as mutual interest between both parties as to working forward, nothing more. There in itself is saying, this is not a purchase agreement, there's no agreement in place, all this is a letter of intent.
But you don't contend that she was a resident?
No, I do contend that she is a resident of that house.
You agree she's a resident.
I do agree that she's a resident.
This is her residence.
Right. This is her residence. I do concede that, yes.
The plaintiff's first amended original petition is the live pleading. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it's on index A.
And I'm looking at now. Paragraph 15 says, as a result of defendant's negligent actions and or omissions, plaintiffs have suffered damages. Consequently, plaintiffs seek to file on the damages. Under economic damages, it says plaintiffs seek recovery of all economic damages caused by defendant's wrongful conduct. It doesn't specify that negligence claim is limited to Patricia Von Bargen. It says plaintiffs. That seems to indicate that the father is asserting a tort claim also, doesn't it?
I think by the actual strict reading of that pleading, it would.
So we will have the issue of negligence, duty, breach, causation, perhaps separate damages, though, but the first three elements decided or disputed in two separate proceedings. Same facts, same issues, different damages.
I would agree that there's different damages, yes, number one. Number two, I would argue that there's different facts. And why I'm saying there's different facts is because we actually have to figure out what the actual injuries and the facts that led to Patricia Von Bargen's injuries, which are very separate from the injuries and damages that were done to Ford and 14.
Well, the duty issue is going to be entirely the same, The duty issue is going to be entirely the same.
If Mr. Forster had sold this home to someone else shortly after it were built, and that person had brought personal injury, these same claims, would they be bound by the arbitration clause?
That's a very interesting question, and that would be definitely something that would have to be also looked at in the contract, and if the contract is binding on all future successors of the actual contract itself, and if it's still covered under the warranty, which is expressed within the contract itself. I would think that if a purchase agreement is in place between Mr. Forstein and a future successor to the interest in the home, then that person wouldn't have to be bound by the arbitration clause. The person that signs the purchase agreement from Mr. Forstein. The reason because of that, is if the contract itself says this is bound on the successors in interest. Now, as we've talked about for a few seconds, I think that the most important and pertinent case. Sorry.
It's confusing to me because I thought in response to Justice Heck's question, he said the home builder really could not impose an arbitration clause on other than the immediate signatory. There would be no way to do it. But are you saying that all you'd have to do is put in the contract and heirs, successors, and assigns, and that would do it?
I would argue that you could, although Justice Heck, as he pointed out to me, would be somehow waiving the constitutional rights of these citizens that would not all freely and on their own will enter into the contract. It's difficult. I mean, it's a very, very difficult question. And I think it's a question that must be answered and must be dictated by the actual draft of the contract.
But if you don't think that can happen, which is one of the rationales of the Fleetwood decision, then it seems to me you're left with the position that it can't be enforced against anybody but a signatory.
That's number one. I would definitely argue that. I would definitely argue that the only person that the contract can be enforced against is the signatory. Now, if a signatory can somehow waive his own rights in the contract or waive his rights to a future successor of interest, I would think there would also have to be provision of when the person who entered the contract with the first signatory would have to agree to it as well. So I think there would have to be a provision within the contract itself that Weekly Homes or another home builder would have to come up with that would say if this warranty still exists at the time or if a duty still exists at the time on behalf of the home builder and this home is sold or is futurely assigned, then a new contract must be entered. Or this contract must be expressly agreed to on behalf of the future successor.
Well, should we treat this personal injury claims differently from property claims? For example, let's suppose that I have a boundary dispute with my next-door neighbor, and we enter into an agreement and say if we get into a dispute in the future, we're going to arbitrate this, and it's binding on our heirs and successors and assigns. And then Chief Justice Jefferson buys my home from me. Is he bound by my agreement with the neighbor to arbitrate this boundary dispute?
That's, again, a difficult question.
And should we treat that one differently from a personal injury claim when you either given or buy the home with this clause in it?
Well, I mean, if the contract itself expressly was agreed to by Chief Justice Jefferson, and if he expressly agrees to it.
Well, he just buys the house. He's got the documentation. It's part of the record.
Then again, I'm going to have to agree and defer to the Gaskamp Court. And the Gaskamp Court says that the contract is only binding on the signatories to the contract. In that case, I would believe that his claims that he would have to bring in that case would have to be based in negligence and in common law and not on the contract itself.
So even in the case of a third-party beneficiary who is named in the contract, you don't think because that person is not a signatory that that person would be bound to arbitrate?
Again, that's a difficult question. Because they're named in the contract leads me to believe that we always have to look at the intent of the parties and the drafters of the contract. And if they can get away with if the parties can agree that the third-party beneficiary knew that this contract was being entered on their benefit, and if they were aware of the fact that this contract was being drafted on behalf of their benefit, then that is something maybe they can contract it around. Although in this case, there's nothing to that extent. There's nothing at all that signifies that Ms. Von Bargen was supposed to be a third-party beneficiary. No language within the contract. In fact, they have ample opportunity, if they did have so many conversations and so many discussions with Ms. Von Bargen, where they could have included her as a purchaser.
I'm not clear. So you can or cannot conceive of a situation where a third-party beneficiary is bound?
I think you can conceive only if that third-party beneficiary has the intent to be a third-party beneficiary. That is evidence in the contract. I do not believe that you can have a third-party beneficiary be bound to a contract that is not anywhere evidenced within the contract itself.
So you would substitute the signature requirement in this situation of a third-party beneficiary with evidence that the third-party beneficiary agreed to the terms of the contract.
Which goes beyond
our typical third-party beneficiary jurisprudence, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But fortunately for us, in this case, there is the contract itself.
Suppose the contract said specifically, if there's this problem, we're going to repair it exactly the way Weekly Homes did it. And when your client bought the house, he agreed to that. Your theory, even though the parties intended the repair to be done precisely as it was, your client could still sue.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I absolutely believe that because her claim is based on the negligent return of the employees of Weekly as they performed what was based in that contract.
I'm assuming her negligence claim is that they did it precisely the way her father and Weekly said it would be done in advance.
I still would believe that she would have an independent cause of action.
Any further questions? Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, if the court was to deny this petition for writ of mandamus, it would have disastrous consequences for the home building industry because you will allow artful pleadings to evade very broad arbitration provisions as they are in this case. Now, let me ask you this test for whether a
suit is on a contract. The test, and this is in one of the amicus briefs, the test for determining whether a non-signatory suit based on the contract and is thus subject to arbitration is whether, based on an examination of the factual allegations, the non-signatory's claims are capable of being maintained independently of and without reference to the contract contained in the arbitration clause. The nature of the underlying claims requires the non-signatory to rely on the terms of an agreement containing the clause, then the non-signatory suit is based on the contract, regardless of the labels assigned for legal theories. If the non-signatory need not rely on the terms of the agreement, claims are not on the contract and not subject to arbitration.
Your Honor, we prevail under that test.
Well, but that's what I'm saying. Do you agree with that test?
Yes, Your Honor. That is a test that other courts have used, and we prevail under that test. If you look at the tort claim that's been asserted, they say that Weekly was negligent in attempting to correct or repair the home. As I think Justice Brewster inquired, where does that duty stem from? That duty stems from the contract. The tort claim is legally dependent upon the duty to build a habitable home without negligence and in good and workmanlike manner.
What if they repaired the back steps? And they did it improperly, and a dinner guest came over and stepped through the steps and broke their leg. Would Weekly Homes owe an independent duty aside from the contract to that guest?
No, Your Honor, I think that cause of action would arise against the homeowner, not against Weekly Homes. Now, Your Honor,
how about a product liability claim? There, a visitor, if the boiler blew up or something in the house, a visitor would have a claim. Because product liability is not tied to the contract, bystanders, whatever else. So there would be personal injury claims that might not be covered by occupants or third parties. But it depends on where the duty came from.
That is correct, Your Honor. Well, let's look in the remaining time, the Fleetwood versus Gaskamp case decided by the Fifth Circuit that is relied on so heavily by my opponent. I think that relies on the Fleetwood versus Gaskamp case is misplaced. To be blunt, I believe that panel blew it. They wrongly decided the case. I have great respect for the justice on the panel, the friends of mine, but I think they got it wrong. They ignored what this court said in First Merit. In First Merit, this court said, you do not look at the labels that the plaintiff attaches to the cause of action. You look at the factual allegations. The court in Gaskamp did not look at the factual allegations. They look at the labels. Now, and even though I think that the Gaskamp court got it wrong, there is some language in the Gaskamp case that is very favorable to Weekly Homes. This is what they said in Fleetwood versus Gaskamp. they said, at no point did the Gaskamp children attempt to enforce the contract or sue on the basis of any warranties contained in the contract. Here, the daughter did attempt to enforce the contract by insisting that Weekly Homes comply with the warranty provisions. So she sued to enforce the contract. Not only that, but to pick up on Justice Bevita's question, not only did she sue to enforce the contract, but she accepted the benefits of the contract by cashing that $500 check, which says, for our home. Now, Your Honor, the doctrine of equitable estoppel, I think, should apply here. She cannot have it both ways. She cannot be suing to enforce the warranty provisions of the contract and accept the benefits of the contract and then say, however, I'm not bound by the broad provisions of the contract. For these reasons, Your Honor, we pray that the court will issue a written mandamus.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in Weekly Homes, and the court will now take another brief recess.